Today's Taisho will be on case 41 in the Mumon Khan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 41 is entitled Bodhidharma's Mind Pacifying. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second ancestor stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, "My mind has no peace yet. I beg you, Master, please pacify my mind. Bring your mind here and I will pacify it for you," replied Bodhidharma. "I have searched for my mind and I cannot take hold of it," said the second patriarch, the second ancestor. "Now your mind is pacified," said Bodhidharma. Mumon's comment, that broken-toothed old Hindu, came so importantly, thousands of miles over the sea. This was raising waves where there was no wind. In his last years, he induced enlightenment in his disciple, who, to make matters worse, was defective in the six roots. Why Shasanro did not know four ideographs. Mumon's verse, "Coming east, directly pointing, you entrusted the Dharma, and trouble arose. The clamor of the monasteries is all because of you." Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen here this morning. You know, when you sit with other people like this, it makes a difference in the quality of your practice. And when you practice others, you're helping others to deepen their practice as well. So coming here was beneficial for you and also an act of generosity to everyone in this room. So thank you so much for coming and making this possible, this wonderful practice this morning possible. So today's case is Bodhidharma's mind pacifying. Some of you may be rather new to Zen, and I should explain that Dhammo, Bodhidharma, was the Indian meditation master who brought Zen, or Chan, to China. When he arrived in China, there was already a very active interest in Buddhism. One of the political leaders at the time, Emperor Wu of Liang, was a great sponsor of Buddhism, and he built many temples, and he built libraries, and beautiful stupas, pagodas, as we say, was a very devout practitioner of Buddhism himself. I mentioned in an earlier talk that Emperor Wu was a really good man, and he was so dedicated to practicing this great way that he used to spend he would go up to the temple near his court, near his palace, and would stay in the temple for about a month at a time. And his ministers and political subordinates were terrified he was going to abdicate his throne and go to live in the monastery as a monk, which is where his passion really lay. At one point, Bodhidharma, this great meditation master from China, had a chance to meet with Emperor Wu. And in the history of Zen, this conversation is quite important. Because they didn't understand each other. Emperor Wu was introduced to Bodhidharma, he said to Bodhidharma, "I have done many meritorious deeds, many deeds that will bring good karma and benefit to all sentient beings, I've created monasteries and basically convents. I've built libraries. I've done all of these good deeds. You know, what is my merit? What is the fruit of all this? These holy things that I have done. And Bodhidharma said, actually, it's not about holiness. Not holiness. Great emptiness. It's not about holiness. It's about emptiness. And Emperor Wu was a very good man, but he didn't understand what Bodhidharma meant. And at a certain point, you know, it was one of those conversations that simply end inconclusively and nobody knows what to make of the other person. So Bodhidharma left the court, the palace of Emperor Wu of Liang, and he went up into the mountains. And he lived in a cave for 9 years practicing Pi Kuan, which means staring at the wall. Now, you know, in some schools of Zen, people actually stare at a wall. They don't face each other when they sit, they face the wall. Maybe this is commemorating Bodhidharma's sitting for 9 years facing a wall. Bodhidharma came to China to bring Zen, to bring the Zen school. He had an audience with the Emperor of China, and probably what he might have hoped would happen is that the Emperor of China would be intrigued by this new teaching of Zen, of Chan, and would build Bodhidharma a lovely temple, would build a library, and so on and so on. But none of that happened. When he and the emperor didn't understand one another, he didn't try again. He didn't look for another emperor. He didn't write a popular best-selling book and go on a book tour. He went up into the mountains and faced a wall for 9 years, waiting for proper students to show up. And actually, proper students did show up. After 9 years, students began to show up. Local people would bring food to his cave. And he had two male students and a woman student. And those three people, the two men and the woman, really are responsible for Zen in China. And Zen eventually became the most important lineage or sect of Buddhism in China. Just somebody sitting in a cave waiting for a student to show up. This is an example of great trust. Great trust. You know, Bodhidharma believed that if he purified body, mind, and heart and lived in accordance with the Tao, lived in harmony with the unfolding of events, things would present themselves as they had to. And he would respond with generosity and compassion and intelligence. This is the life of a Zen practitioner. So, you know, we all have plans that don't go the way we expect. We all have events that could be understood as disappointing. And Bodhidharma certainly had an event like that, but he lived on this this trusting mind. He lived by this trusting mind. He went up, when he experienced disappointment, what did he do? He sat down on his cushion, he faced the wall of emptiness, Wu Xin, and practiced and waited for events to unfold accordingly. And one day, a student shows up after 9 years, and he's sometimes called Weiko, or sometimes Japanese people say Eka. He's the second Zen ancestor. He just shows up one day. Bodhidharma's sitting in a cave, and he's been waiting for 9 years for a student to show up. And Wiko Eka shows up. And you would think Bodhidharma would run out with open arms and say, "Finally, I've been waiting for 9 years. Where were you? You know, why? I'm so glad you're here. I was getting nervous." According to the story, he doesn't let Wako in. He doesn't let him in to his cave. Wako's outside in the snow, and he says, "I want to be your student." And Bodhidharma says, "Well, let me think it over." Finally, Bodhidharma doesn't let him in, and the snow is piling up. And in the legend, this is a legend, it did not really happen like this. He cuts off his arm, okay, and presents it to Bodhidharma, saying, "My mind has no peace as yet. I beg you, please show me how to put my mind at rest." And Bodhidharma says, "Bring your mind here and I will put it at rest for you." And Wako says, "I have searched for my mind and I can't find a mind." Bodhidharma says, "Yeah, that's got, now you're getting somewhere. See, now you're getting somewhere." See. So this is so important. This is so important. You know, when we do meditation, we might think that we're, you could even say, I just said it, purifying the mind, right? We could think of meditation as a kind of mental improvement or mental correction, right? So, you know, when I sit down on the cushion, I'm trying to change my mental habits. You know, so there's a certain truth to that, right? I mean, you know, maybe you're easily distracted and you're always on your phone texting and responding to emails and looking at tweets. You know, and you find it hard to focus on anything. And then, you know, you decide to get involved in Zen practice and you come here and you have to put your phone away at least for half an hour. We used to have a person in our group. He lives in the city now, but he was so addicted to his phone that during the breaks, he would go into the bathroom and look at his phone. We sit for a half hour and then we do walking meditation and then we sit for another half hour. During the walking meditation, he'd duck out and look at his phone, check his messages. So that's an addiction. And when people have to put their phones away and turn them off and sit quietly for an hour, it is a wonderful experience, right? You know, you're undoing an addictive habit. And at the end of 30 minutes, you realize, you might or might not consciously realize that you've gone for half an hour without renewing your addictive habit of looking at your phone. And it's probably the case that you feel better. It's probably the case that you feel better. If you come here in the morning, some of us get here at 7 o'clock, and we leave at noon. So that's 5 hours on the cushion, with 5 hours away from the phone, right? Away from the email, away from the news about you know who. Right? See, so good for your quote unquote mind. Right? And at the end of like an hour of sitting, if you don't go into the bathroom and check your text messages during the walking meditation period, you know, at the end of that period, your so-called mind is going to feel much better. You're going to be calmer. You're going to be less stressed. You know, addictions create stress. Addictions are supposed to relieve stress, but they relieve stress and create stress. See? So, you know, basically, if you're under pressure and you have a cigarette, you get a little nicotine rush, and it makes you feel better. It makes you feel less stressed because it distracts you from what's causing you your anxiety, right? You turn off your concerns. You light up a cigarette, you focus on the pleasure you get from the cigarette, right? And then you go back into your work again, and that feels like you've had a little bit of reduction in your stress. But of course, now you have a new stressor, right? Which is you're craving a cigarette all the time. So phones actually work just like that. You know, if you have a phone, I'm sure you can manage it. But often, you know, phones work like that. So when you finish a period, a dry spell with no texting and no phone, you know, your mind probably feels much calmer, but also there's a kind of openness to that, openness. And that feeling is quite, you know, usually when people have that feeling, it brings them back to the cushion. You know, that feeling like, oh, this is, you know, I've been trapped in these compulsive habits. And if I put them aside for an hour, you know, I begin to feel a kind of spaciousness or openness. You know, even if you sit down on the cushion and the whole sit is a struggle to focus on your breath because your thoughts just keep sweeping you away. You know, you're trying to get to the breath and you just get there and then you get caught in one of these loops and it carries you away and then you realize you're not watching the breath and you come back. Even if the whole sit is like that, at the end of the period, you know, you're going to feel better. It's very likely that you will feel that spaciousness. It's like a weight, a little weight has been taken off your shoulders. See? And it's possible to say, you know, this is really good for my mind. This is really good for my mind. And in a certain way, that's true. It's good for your mind. It's good for your mind. You're emptying it. We say in meditation practice, you're emptying out your mind. When you begin to meditate, the teacher might say, just focus on the breath. Let the thoughts go. Empty your mind. See, and people say, I'm emptying my mind. I'm emptying my mind. When people have been sitting half a day, they might say, oh, my mind feels so good. My mind is so empty. It's so spacious. And so there's definitely a kind of like, relative truth to understanding the mind this way. Right now, the most popular form of meditation in America is called mindfulness, right? And mindfulness is a kind of, you could say, mental training. So you're training the mind to be focused and disciplined, to watch this from moment to moment. So you watch your breath, or your watching sensation from moment to moment, and you could go home and say, you know, I'm really more mindful. So, you know, now, when I, in the old days, I used to turn on the TV, pour myself a cup of coffee, and while I was looking at my phone and watching the sports news, I also drank my coffee, you know, and I couldn't tell what my coffee tasted like. You know, now I don't, I sit, I focus on my coffee, I watch my breath, I drink my coffee, I taste each taste, see, mindful. So it's possible to think about meditation as a mind practice, you know, as about the mind. And we're practicing mindfulness, we're purifying our minds, and so on and so on. But actually, that would not, in a deeper sense, be liberating at all. It would not be liberating at all. And if we think about meditation as purifying our minds, even though I say it sometimes, we're actually helping the situation a little bit. But we're also not really, it's like we're treating the symptoms, but we're not getting to the cause of our problem. Which is actually, from the Zen standpoint, the belief that we even have a mind to purify. That we even have a mind that can be in distress, see. From the Zen standpoint, it's the belief in mind itself that gets us into trouble. See. So, you can perform a little experiment. You know, if you think about, say, who, you know, maybe you did this when you were a kid. I don't know if you ever, you know, ever did this as a kid, but I can remember lying in the grass and having a conversation with my brother when I was a kid about what if Dad had... my brother and I had a kind of an overbearing father, and so I think both of us had fantasies about having a better father, you know. There was a guy down the street, Mr. Sayre, and he was the nicest man. And I had always fantasized, you know, what if Mr. Sayre had been, maybe I was mixed up at birth, and I'm really Jim Sayre's son, and I'm not Larry Spellmeyer's son, you know. And I would, you know, my brother and I were lying there, and we said, you know, what if Dad wasn't our father? I'd say, yeah, that would be great, you know, that would be great. You know, somebody who, you know, wasn't chewing us out all the time and on our case and grouchy and judgmental, and I can go on and on. But, you know, then it occurred to us, well, but if he wasn't our father, would we be us, right? And that was the limit of our philosophical inquiry. Then it was like time to get up and go to lunch, right? You know, but it's important, right? If you say, well, we all think there's an essential core to ourselves. There's an essential core. There's a me. There's a Kurt. You know, there's a Kurt. But if you think about it, you know, what if my father hadn't been Larry Spellmeyer? You know, would I be me? And what if my mother hadn't been my mother, you know? What then, right? You know, what if I hadn't gone to Yorkwood Elementary School and Bobby Westbrook was my best friend? What if that hadn't happened, you know? What if I didn't play Rocket Man with Lynn Ann Morrissey in the apartment complex in Baltimore where I used to live, you know, would I still be me? And it's, if you play this game just a little bit, it's pretty clear, right, that you wouldn't be you, that we like to think there's a Kurt, you know, that's been going through all these events, and all that time I've been Kurt, 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 Kurt. But, you know, actually... You know, we know in another way that that can't possibly be true. That, you know, it's true, I'd have the same name, but everything else about me would be different, right? You know, I wouldn't have done this, I wouldn't have done that. You know, there's so many things in life that are like that, things that are really like the essential to who we are or what we are, that we're just a chance, right? You just ask somebody out on a date. Or, you know, when I went to graduate school, I went to the anthropology department and said, what if I go for a master's degree? And they said, well, we can fund you after you get your master's. We'll fund you for the PhD. And I went to the English department and I said, can you fund me for the master's? And they said, yes. So I went into English, right? I had zero money. It was the best thing I could do. But I didn't go into anthro. I went into English. You know, it was just an afternoon. I talked to two graduate directors, right? And I did some math, and I thought, okay, I'll go into English, right? Would I be me if I had gone into anthro? You know, and I think the answer is no. We like to think there's an essential self, right? You know, but if you think about it, you're just the sum of these events, you know. In the Buddhist sutras, identity is compared to a bamboo stalk or a banana plant, you know. And you could compare it to an onion, right? I mean, that's the cliche in our culture. You know, you peel the onion, try to get to the core of the onion. There isn't any onion core. There isn't anything inside, you know, you can peel away the layers of bamboo, but in the stalk of a bamboo, there's no center. It's an empty center. And the bamboo, and the same thing, banana plant, you know, also in all the sutras it talks about, the banana. You know, you can take the fronds off, you could take the fronds away from the banana plant to get to the core of the plant, but there isn't any core of the plant. And actually, you know, from the Buddhist standpoint, the self is like that. It's not non-existent. But it doesn't have a core. There isn't any essential curtness there. You know, it's just, you could think of it as, it's like a system. It's like this, all of these things over time made me who I am. But if you took them away, there's not something left over. Another good example is Rutgers University, you know? When you try to tell people where Rutgers University is, I could say, well, there's the Rutgers campus on George Street. And they'd say, well, is that the real Rutgers University? And I'd say, well, actually, no, there's also a campus on Douglas. And they'd say, well, that's the real heart of Rutgers, right? And say, well, actually, no. There's also a campus on Bush. Well, is that the real Rutgers? You know, how about Livingston? You know, none of them is like the Rutgers, right? And the interesting thing is, over time, all the buildings at Rutgers are going to be torn down. Some, I wish sooner rather than later. You know, there are some truly ugly buildings at Rutgers. All of the buildings are going to be torn down sooner or later, and it could still be Rutgers, right? And in fact, it's absolutely guaranteed that every faculty member at Rutgers now will be gone in 50 years, and it will still be Rutgers. So you can say, well, there never was a Rutgers. But there was a Rutgers. There just wasn't a Rutgers the way we think of it, an essential Rutgersness, right? And a self is just like that. And a mind is just like that, see? The mind is just like that. There isn't a core to the mind, you know? There isn't a core to the self. And this runs counter to a lot of what our culture teaches us, right? Our culture teaches us, you know, we say, be true to yourself. Know yourself, right? And the assumption is there's a kind of essential curtness that I might not know yet, and I've got to get to know. My parents wanted, I was good in the sciences, and my parents, especially my mother, wanted me to be a doctor. And when I got through my first 4 years of college, I went hitchhiking across the United States. And my mother was a really nice person, and she didn't express her disappointment, but I know she was disappointed. She would have wanted me to go to medical school or something. And instead, I went hitchhiking across the United States. And when she would talk about what I was doing to people in my family or to her friends, she'd just say, "Well, Kurt is finding himself. Right? He's finding himself." And that made sense to her, and it made sense to her friends. You know, he's finding himself. And you know, the idea is there's an essential. I get to know myself better by, you know, going around the country and so on, and eventually I'll know who I really am. You know, and there's lots of books about this. You know, basically getting to understand yourself. Who are you really? And there is some truth to this. I don't want to dismiss it completely. You know, so you know, if you do say, if you go into therapy, for example, you know, you uncover things that were part of your life experience that you didn't want to look at or didn't want to confront. And you can say, you know, I'm understanding myself much better through this process. And that's, in a relative sense, that's absolutely true. You know, that's absolutely true. There is a kind of conditional self, and that conditional self does have baggage. And if you start looking around in among all that baggage, you discover things about your past and about the choices you've made, and so on and so on. So those are all highly useful. So I'm not saying that it doesn't have enormous benefit. But if you think about what something like therapy involves, or something I know better, which is Zen training. You know, the problem is that the problem isn't that the problem is that people are trying to protect their minds and hold on to their minds and protect themselves and hold on to themselves, and that that's actually the source of their suffering. And actually, what would be liberating is to stop trying to hold on to your mind and stop trying to hold on to yourself. That what causes us so much suffering is that operation, that enterprise. And everything in our culture says do that. Everything in our culture says hold on to your, find your true self and follow it to the end, right? You should march, we say, so-and-so marches to a different drummer. You know, there's a very famous philosopher, Emerson, he says, you know, if you're true to yourself, people will knock on your door. You won't have to go looking. Yeah. But you know, from the Buddhist standpoint, you know, actually that's rather bad advice. You know, it's when we're trying to desperately hold on that we cause ourselves suffering. You know, one way to think about what happens in, say, therapy isn't that you're discovering your true self, but that you're getting rid of a lot of things that you couldn't get rid of because you were clinging to that self, you know? About a year ago, we had an event at one of our sesshins that we haven't ever had in 25 years. We had somebody who had a psychological emergency. On the sixth day of our seventh day sesshin, early in the morning while I was making tea, somebody who came to our sesshin had, you know, what is commonly called a breakdown. And she was in the bathroom and she started screaming at everybody. And she tore Sandy's robe and she pushed somebody down. And she went out into the field near where we do sesshin, and she tore off all her clothes. And Sandy had her wits about her and phoned some people from the county, and they came and took her to the hospital. She was released immediately, same day, and you know, one of the things she said to me before this episode was, "I feel like I'm losing my mind. I feel like I'm losing my mind." And indeed, you know, actually, please don't leave yet, but Zen really is about losing your mind. See, it really is. It's about losing your mind. But if you lose your mind, you won't start shrieking, you won't tear Sandy's robe and push somebody down in the bathroom and run out and tear your clothes off in the field. That's produced by not letting go of your mind, not losing your mind. See, when I see that behavior, I say that's somebody who's fighting very, very, very hard not to let go of this illusion of the self. That's a person who has a lot of investments in an identity and in a way of dealing with experience that causes that person a lot of pain, but is still, that person's still not ready to let go of it. And so that person's fighting tooth and nail to save that mind, see, that illusion of a mind. You know, when you lose your mind, when you really lose your mind, you feel present, clear, calm, alive, loving. See, all of those things come from losing your mind. All, you know, all of the distress and the unhappiness that that poor person experienced comes from trying to hold on to it. You know, trying to hold on to it. It's the opposite of what we think. You know, people, when they experience suffering or when they experience fear, they intensify the barriers between themselves and the world. You know, they intensify their distance. Fear causes us to withdraw. It causes us to consolidate, you could say, the self or the mind or the identity. And that actually intensifies our suffering. You know, I don't know if you've known a hoarder in your life, but my mother, who was really my best friend, you know, she was a hoarder, and there was nothing we could do about it. You know, when my mother finally died, my sister and I went into her condo, and it was just as we expected. She had every dress she had ever owned, I think since 1924, right? And the closet was like filled, that you literally couldn't move the dresses, you know, in her closet. And she had hoarded, it was like every pair of shoes she ever owned. You know, some of this comes from living through the Great Depression, this terrible trauma. But she had a hoarding mentality. She would have spaghetti, and then she would save the box. And there were like a pile of compressed boxes, right, in a closet. It's like, what are you going to do with that, Mom? You know? And my sister would periodically go and try to get some of the stuff out of my mother's house, out of her condo. And, you know, as soon as my sister would get rid of this stuff, my mother would start creating new stuff, you know. So you could go into her apartment and you could take all the cardboard boxes and put them in the trash and say, now, isn't that nice, Mom? You know, it's very clean, neat. And then, you know, a year later, it would all be filled up again. She would buy cans of things that she would never eat. You know, some of this is coming from this time of scarcity, but it's complicated, right? But the thing is, I think my mother was insecure. And the way she dealt with her insecurity was to fill up her house. So there's always plenty of food. There's always plenty of cardboard boxes in case anybody needs an old spaghetti box. Right, just in case. Like string. Oh, plenty of string here. That's good. That's a response to fear and anxiety. But, you know, the more junk you put in there, the harder it is to get rid of the junk, right? And we do this mentally all the time. You know, our happiness would come from losing our minds. But when we feel insecure, we take the opposite route, right? We do the opposite thing. We double down on our identities. We double down on, we start trying to fill our mental closet with things that will make us special, right? So, maybe if you're insecure about your intelligence, you might read the New York Review of Books faithfully. And, you know, I was going into the city the other day. Barbara and I were going in to see Ja Rule in the city. And there was a guy on the New Jersey Transit train next to us. And he was reading the New York Review of Books. And somebody said, is that an interesting magazine? And this guy is probably an academic or something. He looked at the other guy sort of like, oh, magazine? Now this is the New York Review of Books. You vulgarian, you know. What do you read? You know, the Post or something, you know. He didn't say that, but there was a slight condescension in his answer, right? You know, I see that as insecure, right? I mean, he's reading, first of all, you know, I can think of more interesting things to do actually on the train than read the New York Review of Books, right? Just looking at the window is, I think, more interesting. But that's his thing. It's his thing. But you're making a public statement about who you are when you read the New York Review of Books on the train, right? And you open it up and you disappear behind it, right? So So look, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he's a wonderful guy. Maybe he wasn't a snob. But all the same, we all do that, right? We all try to fill our house, our mental house, with things that will protect us and make us special. It's like Emperor Wu of Liang meeting Bodhidharma. And here, you know, Emperor Wu is a good man, right? He's a good guy. And, you know, he gets up every day and he recites the sutras. And he probably says, you know, every day and every way I'm getting better and better. And he's a good guy, you know. He's a wonderful human being, but he's still living in a kind of jail if he thinks that he's improving himself or improving his mind or making himself a better person. Those are all, from the Zen standpoint, imprisoning fantasies. Lose your mind. Please lose your mind. See, and so when Emperor Wu of Liang met Bodhidharma, he said, look at all the things I've done. He said, I've read every sutra. Ask me a question. Surangam Sutra, I've got it. You know, a flower ornament, cover to cover. You know, it's 1,300 pages. I've read it all. Just ask me. Ask me about something, you know. And he says, temples? I've built temples, man. And Bodhidharma said, it doesn't matter. It's not about holiness. Holiness is a quality that you cultivate. It's an acquisition. See, it's a personal quality. Oh, he's so holy. You know, what would that mean? Well, it certainly wouldn't mean he's liberated. And Bodhidharma, whom I am so glad existed once, you know, cuts through all the BS. He says, you know, that doesn't matter at all. Those are just the cardboard boxes you've put in your closet because you're feeling insecure. It's not about holiness. It's not about purifying your mind because there is no mind. It's you're empty like a bamboo stalk, and it's about realizing that emptiness. See. That's what Bodhidharma said to Emperor Wu of Liang. And in this koan, you know, the second great Zen ancestor, Weiko, is a scholar. You know, we know a lot about him. He really existed. He was basically like a Confucian scholar who was very unhappy with his life. He was very learned. He had lots of cardboard boxes in his closet. He had, you know, he had passed the imperial exam, whatever, you know. And he was miserable. And he went to see Bodhidharma and he said, you know, help me, you know, put my mind at rest. And Bodhidharma could have said, okay, now here's how you do it. First of all, sit down on the cushion and watch your breath. See, now notice, is your mind getting calm? Yes, yes, calmer, calmer. And he could say, now watch this, you know, just follow the breath out, right? Now notice your thoughts are disappearing. See, your mind is becoming pure. And he could have done that. Emperor Wu would have said, and Weiko would have said, oh, thank you so much, you're a great teacher. But instead, Bodhidharma says, let me help you out. You said your mind is in distress. Show me your mind. And of course, Weiko looks inside, and he can't find any mind because there isn't any mind. He just sees right away. He's a highly intelligent person. He's probably done a lot of meditation. He suddenly realizes one right away. There's no such thing as mind. There isn't any mind. What you're thinking right now is just a product of where you are, what you did yesterday. There isn't any core to any of this. And when we lose our minds, when we try not to lose our minds, we're trying to control everything. We're trying to put the cardboard boxes in our closet. And that drives us crazy, right? That drives us crazy. But when we lose our minds, you know, the mind, when you sit down on the cushion and you watch the breath, what you're really doing is losing your mind. You're not purifying your mind, you're losing your mind. The illusion of mind disappears and you become empty like the blue sky, 蓝天, blue sky, unobstructed, infinite in all directions, no past, no present, no content. This is the mind, see. And Weiko says, thanks, that was great. And if Weiko hadn't discovered that, he wouldn't be free. If Weiko hadn't discovered that, Bodhidharma wouldn't have set him free. Showing the essential emptiness of the self, the essential, because when you get to that emptiness, you feel wonderful. You feel free. You feel ageless. You feel compassion. You feel you're creative. You can respond to things because you're not coming from, you have nothing to lose. Nothing to lose is good, right? Nothing to lose is good. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second patriarch stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, my mind has no peace. My mind is on fire, right? I beg you, please bring peace to my mind. Bring your mind here and I will pacify it for you, replied Bodhidharma. And then the second ancestor says, I have searched for the mind and I cannot take hold of it. And Bodhidharma says, yes, that is Zen. That is freedom. There is no mind. Mumon's comment. Remember that when Mumon insults somebody, he's paying him a compliment. This is Zen style. So in Zen, you don't want to compliment somebody you really admire because you know that they're not going to be moved by your compliment. They have an empty mind and they know compliments are BS, right? Compliments mean, I'm going to stroke your ego if you stroke my ego, at least from the Zen standpoint, see? So in Zen, people don't compliment each other. The great Zen master, great Zen teacher, Shunryu Suzuki, D.T. Suzuki. His Dharma name was Blockhead. Blockhead. See, and that was like high praise. Oh, Suzuki, he's a blockhead. So really? Very good. So when Mumon says, that broken-toothed old Hindu, he's paying a high compliment to Bodhidharma. He knows Bodhidharma doesn't need a compliment. That broken-toothed old Hindu came so importantly, thousands of miles over the sea, bringing Zen to China. This was raising waves where there was no wind. In his last years, he induced enlightenment in his disciple, who, to make matters worse, in other words, to make matters better, was defective in the six roots, in other words, was deeply awake. Why, Shisanro didn't know four ideograms. He was free from birth and death. Mumon's verse, coming east, directly pointing, you entrusted the Dharma and trouble arose. In other words, people were liberated. The clamor of the monasteries is all because of you,